Psalm 127 is the eighth in the series of 15 songs of ascents. Therefore, when you take a look at it, it has this title in the Hebrew original, a song of ascents, as do all these 15 song of ascents. But then it also adds here, of Solomon. Now, most people believe that Solomon was in fact the author of this psalm. Yet the Hebrew phrasing would allow the idea that this psalm was composed by David for Solomon. I'm going to consider Solomon to be the author in my explanation of the psalm, but I just want to suggest that to you. Here, I believe that Solomon is really speaking in a powerful and poetic way about God's work in building houses, in building cities, and in building families. G. Campbell Morgan said this, thinking about this psalm as a whole. He said, "The strength of the Hebrew people is in the past, and all that remains of it today largely results from their keen sense, which they ever cherished, of the importance of the home and the family. The house, the city, labor, all are important to the conserving of the strength of the family." Now, it's interesting, if I could just make a comment on that line that I read to you from G. Campbell Morgan. When he was writing in the early part of the 20th century, he said the strength of the Hebrew people is in the past. He hadn't contemplated the establishment of the modern state of Israel in 1948. He was looking at their strength as just being a passing, but he said that strength was preserved by their emphasis on the home and family, which is reflected in this beautiful, powerful psalm. Psalm 127, again, it's a work that speaks about God's building work in houses, in cities, and in families. Here we go. Verse 1. "Unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. Unless the Lord guards the city, the watchman stays awake in vain." Solomon understood that the work of man has its place, yet the work of man is of little ultimate use without the work and blessing of God upon it. Without God's work and blessing, we labor in vain. Again, look at those lines from verse 1. "Unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it." Again, to quote G. Campbell Morgan, he said, "No house building is successful which leaves God out of account. How we have seen men build only houses with great care and at great cost, only to see them crumble to pieces because God was forgotten." No, when it says, "unless the Lord builds the house," we're talking more about a structure made with bricks and mortar and wood and all the rest of it. No, we're talking about what God builds in a home, so to speak. It's very important for us to understand, without the Lord, there comes nothing but vanity. Things are destroyed. Things pass away. G. Campbell Morgan said those wonderful words about this importance of building and having God's preeminent idea in what we do and what we build, that we can never forget God. James Montgomery Boyce, in his commentary on Psalm 127, says something similar. He says, "A Latin motto says, Nisi Dominus Frusta." It comes from the first words of this psalm, and it means, without the Lord, frustration. Boyce says, "That is the motto of the city of Edinburgh, Scotland, appearing on its crest, and it is affixed to the city's official documents. It could be attached to the lives of many who are trying to live their lives without the Almighty." It's true. Without the Lord, frustration. Now, when we read these words, "unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it," and we've been considering that he means house here in verse 1 in a literal sense, you know, a physical structure, it's possible that the house being built here is actually a family. In the Old Testament, it was used at times to speak of a family as being a house. Even today, as we could speak of a prominent family as being a dynasty or a house of this or a house of that. Either way, we get the point. Unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. Unless the Lord guards the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. Now, the watchman has his role, and he should stay awake. We're not here to praise the sleeping watchman, no. But without God's work and blessing, that is what is needed to truly guard the city. Now, when we consider just verse 1 here, unless the Lord builds the house, unless the Lord guards the city, it's especially meaningful to us that Solomon wrote this psalm. Because Solomon knew what it was like to both build a house and to guard a city. Wise Solomon understood that though God welcomed, and we could say even commanded, human effort and participation, God's work and blessing were more important. Yes, the builder needs to do his job, as does the watchman over the city, yet they must do it all along the way, trusting the Lord. Again, to quote G. Campbell Morgan, you can tell I like his perspective on this psalm a lot. He said, "These would be splendid words to cut into granite over the entrance of all of our homes and to emblazon in gold at the meeting places of those in civic authority. Better still, let them be written in the heart of those who make homes and guard and govern cities." We need these words, yes, publicly seen, but more importantly, hidden in the heart. Now, verse 2, he's going to talk about the vanity of reliance upon the strength of man. Verse 2, "It is vain for you to rise up early, to sit up late, to eat the bread of sorrows, for so he gives his beloved sleep." What a powerful statement. It is vain for you to rise up early. Now, I don't know about you, but I like to get up early. Some of my most productive work is done early. I do a lot of my Bible teaching here for this platform in this particular room early in the morning. And we gather that Solomon did not speak against getting up early and working hard. After all, if you turn to the book of Proverbs, you'll see many of Solomon's proverbs praise the hard worker who rises early. If you want an example of that, go to Proverbs chapter 6, verses 6 through 11. But from the first verse of this psalm, we understand that Solomon intended the trust that many people put in their own hard work. That's what is vain. The anxiety that people cling on to, that shows a reliance on self, not God. And so in that sense, it is vain for you to rise up early, to sit up late, to eat the bread of sorrows. Again, he's not promoting laziness. He's not saying, sleep in. Don't work too late. Just take it easy all the time. No, he's saying it's vain for you to get up early and work hard. It's vain for you to stay up late and work hard. It's vain for you to do all those things and to forget about God. The only thing you'll gain from that is the bread of sorrows. Why don't you go and get some of the sleep that God gives to his beloved? The commentator writer Thomas Manton had a good definition of what the bread of sorrows were. He says, "It's living a life of misery and labors, fretting at our own disappointments, eaten up with envy at the advancement of others, afflicted overmuch with losses and wrongs. There is no end of all their labors." Now listen, we need to trust God. Yes, work hard. But all your hard work without trusting God, it has the potential to bring great sorrow in your life. You'll just be eating the bread of sorrows. As we said before, take a look at the last line of verse 2. Look at what's preferred. Just get the sleep that God gives to his beloved. Now, men who are affected by reliance on their own hard work and experience, they experience the anxiety that often comes with it. God's blessing is to give his beloved ones sleep. They can be at peace knowing that God's hand is at work, that God's eye is watching even as they sleep. Now, very interesting here in verse 2, that phrase, for so he gives his beloved sleep. There are more than a couple of commentators who believe, again, James Montgomery Boyce is one of them, that this may be a hidden or even cryptic reference to Solomon himself. He gives his beloved sleep. In Hebrew, the words are actually connected to a title or a name that was given to Solomon in 2 Samuel chapter 12, verse 25, Jedida, meaning beloved of Jehovah. Maybe that's who he's referring to there. But again, whether or not it refers to Solomon, we long for it to refer to us. We want the blessed sleep that God gives to his beloved. And if you're having sleep problems, which many people do, take this verse before the Lord. Say, Lord, you say here in your word that you give your beloved sleep. I know that in Jesus Christ, I am beloved by you. Lord, I ask that tonight you would give me sleep. F.B. Meyer said of this idea, he said, "Begone, dull, worrying care. Let me rest, sweet faith and hope. Close my eyes and still my heart. Jesus, give me sleep. And in sleeping, give me my heart's desire that I may awake and be satisfied." It's beautiful, isn't it? Now, let's go on to verse 3 and take a look here at what he has to say about blessing upon the family. To introduce this, let me read you something from Bishop Horn, that Anglican commentator from a few hundred years ago. He said, "The labors of mankind, first in building houses and cities, and then in guarding and securing their possessions, are undergone not with a view to themselves alone, but to their families, which they would establish and perpetuate." In other words, he's considering the work that's spoken of in the first three verses, or the first two verses, I should say, the work of building houses and guarding cities. Now, those are great works. Wonderful to build a house, wonderful to guard a city, but why do we do that? It's so that our family can have a safe, secure place to live and to thrive. So very fittingly, he comes to the subject of family now in verse 3. "Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward." Solomon considered the wisdom of trusting God in building a house, that's in verse 1, but he also understood that really a home is built by more than having, you know, straight beams and good bricks and wood and all the rest of it. He called everybody to behold something. Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord. Children are a blessing. I mean, after all, any person would ask, especially an ancient Jew, why are you building a house? What's the good of it? The house is for a family. Why are the watchmen doing their work of protecting the city? Why do they do it? They do it to protect my family. Back then in the ancient world, even to the present day, the family was and is the most basic fundamental unit. It is the most important element of society. When family breaks down, society will break down. Spurgeon said, this is done through children. He says here, he gives children not as a penalty nor as a burden, but as a favor. They are a token for good if men know how to receive them and educate them. They are doubtful blessings only because we are doubtful people. No, children are a blessing. Children are a heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward. Sadly, though Solomon had, and this is according to 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 3, Solomon had 700 wives, and he had 300 concubines. Do you know that we only know of one of his specific descendants? Perhaps Solomon knew very little of this reward. Now, I believe Solomon had more than one child, but we're only really told of one. As the Puritan commentator John Trapp said, he said, This last was a fit lesson for Solomon, who, by so many wives and concubines, left but one only son that we read of, and him not the wisest. Isn't it interesting? Solomon here is recognizing that many children are a reward, and Solomon had the potential to have hundreds of children, literally. We only read of one. As Derek Kidner observed, like much of Solomon's wisdom, the lessons of this psalm, relevant as they were to his situation, were mostly lost on him. His building, both literal and figurative, became reckless. You can see that in 1 Kings chapter 9. Solomon's kingdom eventually became a ruin. You can see that in 1 Kings 11:11. And his marriages became a disastrous denial of God. You can see that in 1 Kings 11 as well. Solomon could sing about this. Solomon could give us some wonderfully wise proverbs about this. But sadly, he never really lived this principle in abundance. The man who said to us, "Behold, children are a heritage to the Lord, the fruit of the womb a reward," he knew very little of that reward, at least that we know of, at least that the scriptures explain to us. Now, verses 4 and 5, the two concluding verses of this psalm, Solomon says, "Like arrows in the hand of a warrior, so are the children of one's youth. Happy is the man who has his quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed, but shall speak with their enemies in the gate." Here, Solomon likens children to being arrows in the hand of a warrior. And in many ways, children are like arrows in the hand of a warrior. First of all, Solomon's thinking what a blessing it is to have children. Well, the more arrows you put in the hand of a warrior, the more fighting he can do, the more strength he can project. And so more is to be preferred rather than less. So that's one idea there, but that's not the only idea at all. You could say that in many ways, children are indeed like arrows in the hand of a warrior. Number one, just like arrows, children must be carefully shaped and formed. Secondly, just like arrows, children must be guided with skill and strength. When an arrow sets out to do its work, it has to be guided by a skillful person. Like children, arrows must be given care or they will not fly straight. Like arrows, children must be aimed and given direction. They will not find direction on their own. Children, like arrows, are, in some respects, only launched once. For the most part, when that soldier's in battle fighting with a bow and arrow, each arrow gets launched once. And then, in some sense, just like arrows, children are an extension of the warrior's strength and accomplishment. And finally, just like arrows, children have the potential for much good or great evil. Now, again, notice, arrows don't happen by accident. As far as we know, a branch never just fell off of a tree and gave itself to be a truly useful arrow. No, the archer must gather those sticks and must carefully, attentively shape them. They need to be made smooth by grace. And then, as Bishop Horn said, they need to be ready winged with duty and love to fly to the mark. They need to be polished and keen to grace. And they need to maintain the cause of their parents who serve as the archers to launch those arrows. As Boyce understood, it's vain to build a house without God. It's vain to watch over a city without depending on God, but it's even more foolish to try to raise a family without God. So, children are like arrows, it says, in the hand of a warrior. Verse 5, happy is the man who has his quiver full of them. If children are a reward, that's what it says in verse 3, then there's great blessing and happiness in having many children. If you have a lot of children, In some sense, it's work, it's a burden. But in biblical times, as well as in our own days, there is great blessing that comes from it. Now, look, I understand everybody's situation is different. There are some people who have a different calling in life altogether. But in general, please take those words seriously, I say, in general, Christians should have a lot of babies. The world needs more children raised in godly homes. The world needs more arrows that will be skillfully shaped and launched into the world. It's a blessing, not only for the family, but for the world, for believers who long to raise their children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord to have a quiver full of those arrows. And again, I understand each individual before God has to figure this out between them and the Lord. But in general, speaking in a very general sense, it's good for Christians to have many children. As Spurgeon recognized, he said, "A quiver may be small and yet full, and then the blessing is obtained. In any case," Spurgeon said, "we may be sure that a man's life consists not in the abundance of children that he possesses." You can't automatically say that if you have many children, you're going to have a blessed, wonderful life. The two don't go together. No, we need to figure these things out before the Lord. But in general, it's a wonderful thing. I remember reading in Spurgeon's Treasury of David, he gives the story of a man named Joseph Hall. It's really a touching story. I'll read you. These are the words of Joseph Hall. He says, "I remember a great man coming into my house at Waltham and seeing all my children standing in the order of their age and stature. And the great man said, 'These are they that make rich men poor.' But he straight received the answer from me, 'Nay, my lord, these are they that make a poor man rich, for there is not one of these whom we would part with for all your wealth.'" What a great answer to an arrogant man who considered children a source of poverty instead of enrichment. There's an old German proverb that I read in a commentary that says, "Many children make many prayers, and many prayers bring much blessing." Well, that's true if nothing else is. Now notice here, verse 5, I'll read it again. "Happy is the man who has his quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed, but shall speak with their enemies in the gate." The gate of an ancient city was a place of business and justice. This verse speaks of the children of the godly having places of prominence and influence in their communities. And so this is a wonderful idea here that the children of the godly, God can give them places of prominence and blessing for the community. Again, I believe that it is a blessing not only for the family to have more children, but it is ultimately a blessing for the community to have more people in it that were raised in good and godly homes. Well, let's consider now, how might we see that Psalm 127 points to Jesus? Well, I would suggest this way. We can see that Jesus is the builder of the house and the guard of the city. Verse 1 says this, I'll read it to you again. "Unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. Unless the Lord guards the city, the watchman stays awake in vain." Now, Ephesians and 1 Peter tell us that the people of God are the house that Jesus builds. And the book of Revelation tells us of the heavenly city, the new Jerusalem that is guarded by God. All of this collectively, all these New Testament thoughts connect with the idea that in Jesus, we are part of God's family and we can be considered God's children in a particular way. We are children by adoption, but still we are in God's quiver. We are God's family. Jesus is the builder of the house. Jesus is the guard of the city. And in Jesus, we are in the family of God. What a beautiful and powerful thought. Let me conclude now with prayer. Father in heaven, we pray for a blessing upon our families, our homes. Lord, I pray for those who have what we might call literal families. They have a spouse and they have children or they have grandchildren. Lord, put a blessing on those families. Teach us to pray for our families. And Lord, I pray for those perhaps whom in the biblical pattern that you revealed to us in the New Testament, you've called them to singleness. And Lord, you have a calling and a purpose for them. Lord, you've given them spiritual families, families among and connected to the people of God in general. Lord, put a blessing on those families as well. We are persuaded of it, Lord, that it's vain for us to do our work unless you fill it and guide it and bless it every step of the way. It's true for our homes. It's true for our communities. Lord, it is especially true of our families. And we submit those to you gladly. In Jesus' name, amen.